Welcome, everybody. This is the inaugural Artist's Voice Forum Day for Sala, and it's so wonderful to have so many people here for the very first time we've done this event. I'd like to acknowledge that today we meet on the land of the traditional land of the Kaurna people, and that we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. Now, today is all about the artist's voice. It came about through the Sala Artist Advisory Group. It was something that the group were keen to see happen, a chance for us to talk about what happens in the visual arts scene here in South Australia. So I'm not an artist. I'm Penny Griggs. I'm the general manager of Sala. So I'm going to hand over to an artist. Mary Jean Richardson is an artist and lecturer at Adelaide Central School of Art. She actively exhibits locally and nationally and received the 2013 Australian Experimental Art Foundation Chibo Espresso Studio Residency, God, that's a mouthful, at the British School of Rome. She's also part of the management team at Fontenelle Gallery and Studios. Just quickly before I hand over to Mary Jean, I just would also like to thank the advisory group, obviously, and also the Art Gallery of South Australia, Lisa Slade, for hosting us here today. Thank you and enjoy the day.
Thank you, Penny. Look, I'm going to keep this brief because it's a bit of a talk fest today. And I am speaking on behalf of the 2014 Sala Artists Advisory Committee. This committee was put together this year using a broad range of artists' perspectives to discuss and reflect upon the future of Sala. What was clearly evident is that the Sala Festival has successfully established itself as part of South Australia's annual calendar. During this festival, the generosity shown from galleries exhibiting and promoting South Australian artists, artists opening their studios to the public, businesses transforming into temporary galleries, and audiences travelling all around the state pursuing art is really truly remarkable. There was, however, a gap that we identified, and that is the artists who do not show in this festival every year. This group include more established full-time artists whose schedules and commitments don't always coincide with the Sala program. We felt it was necessary to find a place for these artists, an opportunity to come together to engage directly with the ideas and working methods of these people, a place where experiences can be shared and questions asked. So Artist Voice was put together. Today is a glimpse into the depth of practice that exists here in South Australia. And there are so many more people with much to offer. So, like the beautiful Sala publication, we'd really like to see this sort of program incorporated into every Sala festival. We'd also, as Penny said, like to thank the Art Gallery of South Australia for providing this venue. I think it makes us all feel really valued. The artists and curators speaking today, and of course you, the audience, who come and support this venture. So I hope you enjoy the day. We'll start with our first topic, Pursuing the Muse. Artists reflect on the development of core concepts in their work. I'm just going to introduce the panel and then Rod, the interlocutor, will take over. So Rod Taylor AM is a painter based in Adelaide. Rod is a retired associate professor of Flinders University and retired CEO of Adelaide Central School of Art, which he co-founded with his wife Heather Nicholson in 1982. He studied art in South Australia at the South Australian School of Art and in London at St Martin's School of Art. In 1998, he was awarded a fellowship of the Council of University Art and Design Schools, and in 2010, he received the award of Member of the Order of Australia. He has worked in both private and public collections. In 2008, Central Gallery held a survey of his paintings and drawings from 1980 to 2008. Chris Orchard held his first solo exhibition in 1975. He is a founding member of Central Studios and has had over 40 solo and group exhibitions. Former head of drawing at Adelaide Central School of Art and currently adjunct associate professor at Flinders University, In 1984 to 1987, he joined the Air and Space Studios, Berry Street, London. In 2000, Chris undertook an artist residency at the Gunnery Studios in Sydney. In 2002, he taught drawing at the New York Studio School. And in 2011, was awarded the Arts SA Established Artist Fellowship. He maintains studio practice in Adelaide and New York. Next is Nicholas Folland. Nick is one of South Australia's foremost visual artists, known for transforming the everyday, the overlooked, and the no longer fashionable to make work that reflects on our history and identity. He has exhibited solo across Australia, with work held in the Art Gallery of South Australia, the National Gallery of Victoria, and the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia. The latest Sala monograph from Wakefield Press explores his work through a collection of illustrated essays. Next is figurative painter Anna Platten. She presents painted scenarios for the outside world that, despite appearing elaborately fabricated and unreal, reveal the artist's own emotional reality. Platten's work charts her rites of passage over time, her embarkation into an artistic career, her marriage and motherhood, and the awakening of middle age. As her work has progressed, likewise the spatial realm of her narrative has expanded. In 2012, a major survey of Anna's work was held here at the Art Gallery of South Australia. And finally, Giles Bettison. Giles is a master glass artist. He has evolved the ancient Venetian technique called murini, or mosaic glass, to construct pattern sheets from coloured glass canes. He cuts and combines these sheets to build his luminous vessels piece by piece. Bettison is known worldwide for his pioneering efforts using this technique. His work is incredibly unique, combining old and new technology to create some of the finest glass available today. Since art school, Giles has been exploring ideas about connection, beauty, pattern, and perception. He has also worked on series that comes out of two themes that he has always returned to, landscape and textiles. Giles is also the recipient of the upcoming 2015 Sala monograph. So, thank you.
Okay. When I was asked to convene a session, I wasn't quite sure what my role would actually be. But I assume that the function of the role of this gathering is to clarify some things. And common feedback to me over the years from the public, and I can see most of you that I can see are probably in the arts, but I thought maybe there'd be a lot more public here, but who weren't so involved in arts. And a question always comes out, well, what's it all about? What is art and everything? It's a common kind of question. There's usually a mystery about it. So I thought I would sort of try to contextualise the discussion a little bit, not that I've spoken to any of the other speakers, so they don't know really what I'm going to say or how I'm going to contextualise it. But I thought I'd say a few things to help draw out some of the questions that the public might be interested in knowing, might be this, to draw out some understanding about the whole thing. Well, the topic is the muse, and as you know, as a noun, the muse is a source of inspiration. So one way we could look at it is to say, well, what inspires everybody? Each of these speakers could say what inspires them. But there's also the other side of it, which I find useful myself, that is, inspired to do what? What is it? Now, all the philosophical discussions about what is art have been very unresolved, as any of you who've studied any theory would know. There's no one's come to any conclusions about that. It seems an insolvable, unresolvable kind of matter. But it doesn't have to leave us in any kind of doubt about what we're talking about, because all we have to do is go to a museum and look at the stuff in there and say, well, that is art. That's the stuff we're calling art and have always done so. You can flip through survey books on art and say that's the stuff. When we look at this stuff, one way to understand it, apart from saying, well, that's the stuff we're talking about, is to, first of all, we know that it's this kind of stuff has been made since people have been around, human beings around, maybe, I don't know, 100,000, 60,000, definitely 30 or 40,000, we know that this kind of stuff has been dated. And it's useful for me to think, well, what does this stuff do? What has this stuff done? And again, it's not a big mystery, really. There's a sort of fairly small list of things, really. It's been used to help tell the tribe's stories or the society's stories. We know that, of course, that's done also by today programs like Breaking Bad, etc. But telling the stories, the tribe's stories, it's been told to record things, record events, who won this war and that war and who was, you know, important at the time, who got married and who didn't, etc., etc., that kind of thing, record things, record the landscape and property and that kind of thing. It's been used almost universally to decorate things. Artists have been used to decorate things, to beautify things. I think we probably share that with some animals as well, but nevertheless, it's a common human thing to decorate stuff, beautify it. We seem to need it and like it, and that's been one of the roles of the people that we call artists. It's assisted in rituals. There's hardly any rituals, religious or otherwise rituals, where you need some assistance for people to make things, make objects and images that will assist in that kind of process. And perhaps importantly in more recent times, I mean the last couple of hundred years, it's also been used to help us to know what it feels like to be a human being. How would we really know otherwise unless it's through the kinds of things that artists do? Scientists tell us a lot how people work, how things work, but they don't tell us what it's like to have the experience of being a human being. So artists have actually done that as well. So I find it very helpful to me to try and understand the things that we call art, the stuff that we call art, by doing that, by saying, well, what does it do? And I'll be very interested to hear from our speakers to hear what they think it does and what they think they're doing in that context. So I hope that approach helps a little bit, helps some stimulate some way of approaching this without getting too convoluted. Okay, well, over to our speakers. Chris, I think it's yourself first.
Yeah. I have never done this. I have a script. Because I need to stay on track, and I know I've only got a few minutes. I trained at the South Australian School of Art, majoring in sculpture, that became, along with teaching, my dominant practice. Kind of remains so today. This was around 1973, and I was pursuing large-scale steel fabrication influenced by Anthony Caro, Sol LeWitt, and the serial motif, or gesture. Increasingly, my work was built around the repeated thing within the constructed installation of welded steel, fabric, rope, and stained canvas. Poor old Ian North, I think I did a link exhibition at the Art Gallery South Australia in 76, and I had a painting 110 feet long, and it came down on the floor and did all sorts of things, and I think Ian had a quiet conniption out the back, but nevertheless it went ahead. So in 1976, while this direction in my work was flourishing and gaining recognition, I was constantly longing for a language of image that for me only drawing could possibly deliver. So in 1976, I began a re-engagement with drawing, and in particular figurative representation, the weakest area of my practice due to a limited training and experience. Travel in Europe for a year, visiting major collections, provided powerful encounters with drawing by masters from the 15th century to the 20th centuries. In a way, they became my mentors. And as time passed, I began to search the role of imagination and memory in the construction of figurative drawings. And in particular, the freedom to create an archetype, a figure that could be repeated, the avatar, gradually arrived. An important element underpinning this development was and remains variance and repetition, the fact that one can never make exactly the same thing twice, and that to me this became a mimicry of DNA, the oscillation of acts of representation like a double helix. The act of making as mark, as an increment of representation, always crosses the path of predecessors, but never in exactly the same manner, thus leading to a kind of evolution of the avatar. And, kind of evolution of the avatar in my drawings. The central character of my work, the bald man, is an accretion of experience, memory, amnesia, and reinvention. To some extent, is Vladimir and Estragon in Waiting for Godot, and as such has forgotten that Godot has passed by, thereby necessitating the constant repetition of acts and the inevitable question, what shall we do now? In studio, I begin drawings without predetermined outcomes, maybe at times broad context. Usually I begin with a figure somewhere in the rectangle at a certain scale. From this point, all is improvisation, error, correction, and potential narrative, very much in the manner of a writer of fiction. Almost without fail, what emerges is a tilt at the dominant concerns I may have about the world and the human engagement or otherwise with it. More often than not, I have an overwhelming sense of pathos or compassion, and the avatar stands genderless, just a being in all being. I'm a kind of chronicler.
Would anyone like to ask Chris any questions about his process? Or Chris, it seems pretty obvious to me that you're inspired by literature a lot. Would that be right? Would be true?
Absolutely. Yeah. Spent a lot of time reading, of course, but I read very unfashionable literature in the sense that I like crime fiction, and in particular James Lee Burke and Peter Temple, yada yada. But in fact, what feeds me is not the essence of the story. You know, like I'm crime fiction. Who did it? The butler, etc., etc. It's that sense of the narrative and its construction, and the fact that writers, they intrigue me immensely because they talk about the fact that their invented characters begin to take over, and they end up down cul-de-sacs that they didn't know they were going to go down, and that events within the narrative begin to emerge that they couldn't have expected and so forth. That's what happens to me. I don't even know before I've done about three works what I'm on about. And every time, I've said, people who know me know this, every time I start a work, I'm as dumb as a post.
It's, of course, it's no obligation on anyone to do this, and certainly I'm not trying to put it on Chris, but given the context I suggested earlier, do you have a sense of what you're doing in society, Chris, what your role is?
I do. I really do, because this is a rather lovely outcome. I had an agent in London for a few years. His name was Bill Hopkins. And he said, Christopher, there's only two outcomes for someone like you. Either you become an artist or you become a criminal.
Thanks, Chris. Yes?
I did the latter.
Okay, let's thank you very much, Chris. Nick Foland represents, if you like, the next generation in terms of chronology, and he also uses very different materials, and one would assume, given the difference in materials and the different intellectual ideas, intellectual bases coming from, there'll be a very different perspective. But let's see what Nick believes he's doing.
Thank you, Rod. I guess a couple of things to start with. To start with Rod's question, I guess, you know, what do artists actually do? What do we do in this world? What do we add to the world? And I guess I agree very much with Rod's very first sentiment, that artists tell the tribe stories. I think we're still doing that. I think, you know, we're all part of a tribe or part of many tribes, and you know, our tribe might be a very immediate thing, but there's outreach into the rest of our culture and increasingly outreach to the rest of the world. I think we're a kind of a global tribe now, although we reflect our perception of that tribe from a much more localised position. So perhaps that answers that part of the question. But I think the other thing about us is that as artists we're observers, whether we're dancers, performers, musicians, visual artists of some sort, we're observing the world and we're reflecting on that world, whether we're responding to something that's very, very historical or whether we're responding to something that's very contemporary, we're giving it a perspective that very much relates to the world now, the world that we live in. And I think that's the only way that our work can actually communicate to anyone. It's communicating in the world that we're living now. The people who are receiving the work are the people who are alive now. I can't possibly speak for the people in the past, for works that have been made historically within their own context. I can only ever observe those works and talk about them in my own context. I also can't possibly predict what the future will hold for any work that we maybe hold on a pedestal in this day and age. I think time will tell all sorts of different stories, and we only have to look back through time to see the way works are responded to now. And we know historically that works take on very, very different meanings in the worlds in which they're being observed. So perhaps that answers that question from my own personal perspective too. But I guess going back to that and talking about reflecting the tribe and doing that from a very, very personal and local level, I guess my own work comes really first and foremost from my own place in this world. And very much, I guess, it's kicked off from my own history, from growing up here in Adelaide, from knowing about my own family's kind of history before me and the way my family exists now. They're the things that really primarily inspire my work. But I'm also very much observing the world around me and trying to contextualise that within the way that I understand the world and trying to make sense of it. I guess most of the time I'm actually looking for those points where our world begins to fracture a little bit. And that's often something that we see in the most contemporary of contemporary cultures, is that point where new things are being introduced and there's some kind of fracture that's taking place, where that new thing is in its own way, not necessarily intentionally, replacing something that's already existed or standing in for that in terms of being perceived within the world today. And I think it's that fracturing point that I'm always looking for within our culture. I'm looking for that thing that's standing out to me today that perhaps wasn't here yesterday. And that's not to say that it doesn't draw that history through to the present, but it's very much how that thing might be restructured so that it reveals perhaps the underside of that thing that we're viewing today. I don't have any slides here, but hopefully some of you have seen my work that's in the Art Gallery of South Australia here or at the other shows that are on, or seen work in the past. And I think when you look at my work, you'll first and foremost see things that are generally very, very familiar to you. They're all things that exist around us. I don't see myself necessarily as making new things. I see myself as arranging things in hopefully a new way. When I put things out there, I want you to be drawn to them through your own knowledge of those things, through your own understanding of how the world exists today. But hopefully when you go home, you might see those things that are really familiar to you in a very, very different way. And I guess that in a way encapsulates the way I would perceive my muse. My muse is this world that's around us, the objects and things that accumulate in this world. And my response to that muse is to shuffle it, to twist it, and to present it back to you. I think that's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
Perhaps a commonality between Chris and Nick is that they both were interested in communicating some ideas about their world, their society. Of course, not all artists or people who we've called artists want to do that. Some people who just want to decorate are not particularly concerned to communicate at all. I think we have to move on, unfortunately. Thank you very much, Nick. Thanks, Anna.
Sorry, I was really gratified to hear what Nick just said then about the security guard. That's a lovely story. Rod had told me a few days ago what he was going to throw as the question, and I got a bit upset with him because I didn't really want to talk about this kind of thing. And also I feel it puts me on the spot somewhat as in the means that I have to justify myself in why I do what I do, which I don't. It's fine. Anyway, what I was thinking about it is that, because Rod and I discuss this, we watch Breaking Bad or something like that, and we just think, oh, it's so moving, it's so compelling, it's like Dostoevsky or something, it's just saying everything about our society. So what is the relevance? I mean, in 100 years, will anyone be digging up, hopefully they won't be digging up anything in 100 years, but you know, an anaplatin in 1,000 years or whatever. I mean, it would just be a piece of crap, really. I mean, I'm not saying that to put myself down, but it's my own internal working at my time. So how do I justify doing what I do? And I suppose it's like what Chris said earlier too. I do it because I need to do it. And I'm not saying that like I'm a cripple or anything. It's just that I have a little, what's that word? I try and navigate my own truth as a human. And I know I'm a middle-class white woman living in Adelaide of all beautiful places in the world. So I'm not really very relevant. Like Rod and I went to the, saw the Weimar Republic show. I don't know if anyone went and saw that in Melbourne. It, you know, it was work of artists, a lot of artists after the First World War. And their work, even a tiny, tiny little drawing, was just so incredibly powerful because of what those men principally had experienced. So their truth was so intense, so much bigger than what I could ever in my little, you know, I'm not putting down myself as a woman, but my experience living in Adelaide now, their experience was just so much greater and grander than anything I could ever understand. So their work, because it had that truth, it just resonated and was shocking. A little tiny thing like that was actually shocking. And I think that's the thing that I've always tried to sort of navigate in myself. Like, I know that I am the person with my own experience, but and I know that relative and the relevance of that, especially in today's world, is probably very, very minimal. But I'm driven to, what's the word? I get a feeling when I'm doing something, like before I even get an idea, I just sometimes get a sort of a sense that there's something at the top of my head. So this is probably my muse. And I think, oh, what's that? And I sort of look at it a little bit. And I'm not like Chris. I can't actually see. Chris does all his work without any support materials whatsoever. It just all comes out of Chris's head. I need photographs. I need props. I need all these things to create what I envisage. So even in doing that, I get really frightened when I take photographs of my work because I think, God, I'm making this poor model go through this and for what, you know, because I've got some wacky idea about doing this and this. And it's when I actually put it together that I actually try and make it make sense and to have some kind of resonance with someone else. But that muse, whatever it is, the thing that tells me to do something, I've got over the years to have more trust in myself. Like, I know there's a lot of people that don't relate to what I do, and I've had a man just recently just said he can't see it at all, and do I like Jane Austen? And I do like Jane Austen. But I also do have men say that my work moves them. I won't be very long. But the other thing I was just going to say, so I try to make my work make sense to me, to see why did I envisage this thing as important. And I've learnt my edit thing is basically now when I come up with an idea, like it has to brew for a while and to be bothered to make the props, it's got to be somehow more relevant than some of the other ideas I get. But in the end, I heard something once and I think this makes sense. You can either be driven by the ego or led by the soul. Now, I've got an ego like everybody else and I like to make things that look good or whatever. But if I think that this idea is somehow is leading me along by my soul, not by my ego, and I know they're a hard thing to split, that makes me think, okay, it's justified, it's worthwhile, go with that. And the other thing I'd like to say too, just before I finish, is, and it's great when that resonates with other people, like there's a kind of tuning fork in all of us, I think, that we, when we see truth, we connect, someone else's truth, we connect with it, and our truth, you know, connects with that. So that's good. Not everyone's truth is going to connect with mine. But the other thing I was going to say too, which I think is very relevant in what Rod's saying, is that when I was very young, I mean, and I'm a figurative artist, so I actually don't paint the work I like to see. I wouldn't want a figurative painting in my house, especially not one of mine. And I don't paint. So I'm painting because I want to tell the story. That's why I'm doing it. And I'm using all the forces I've got together to make you believe that what I'm doing is true, because it's the truth for me that conveys hopefully to you. But when Chris was talking about the minimalists, and he could see he relates to that, it was minimalism which I totally was terrified by at art school. And because there wasn't, to me, no meaning in it. And I used to look at the work of the Flemish painters and be so moved by them because they were telling stories. But the thing is, when the Flemish painters painted those paintings, people were being burnt at the stake because of their belief in their religion. And I don't live in that world now. No one believes in anything that much, and we certainly wouldn't die to save the plasma screen TV. You know, it's just a different world, and so our truth is different, and I struggle to find little truths that somehow are relevant to people in this age now and in Adelaide. So that's it.
Charles Bettison.
I, among other things, liked making stuff and eventually decided that I wanted to make my career about making stuff, and I decided to make stuff out of glass and really enjoyed the stories that went around with the glass, and that was the main way of learning was people showing techniques and the stories that were there. I researched into a lot of textiles and folk art and things like that, and then found my own way of reinterpreting what I saw into glass. And I think, well, I needed to find something that my work was about. So the landscape was important to me. Farming was in my family history. So I started to make work that was about the landscape as well. And I eventually ended up figuring out that what it was about was me, I don't know, figuring out how I saw stuff and then interpreting it into the glass. And then art, I guess, in general, is about helping people to see. So that's what I think the job of artists is helping people to see. And so art has to be, well, I think people appropriate art when they look at it, because you can only see it through your own experience. So more and more, I think people build things into art so that you can appropriate it and apply your own experience to it. And there, it's, yeah, I think that's our job, is to help people see and or help people think about the stuff that they're going through. And so I'll make my work about things that are important to me, and then there's room within that for other people to look at it and reinterpret it their own way, or to look at it and say, oh, that looks like this. And as soon as someone sees some other reference in it, they're intellectually involved with the artwork, and really they're intellectually involved with their own thought or existence. And so it's about, I don't know, I think art is about people putting their feet on the ground and understanding where they are, and that's a launch place for understanding life and moving through life and then relating to other people, relating to the place, sense of place, where we are and the importance of that, and taking command of life, and or maybe not command, but being present. So that's what I think the job of art is. And then out of that, it just gets really complicated. So you can just go through layers and layers, and everyone might have issues or not, or they might want to make art about issues, or they might just want to reinterpret or interpret stuff that they see. But just the act of doing that, and as soon as you interpret it, it changes. And so there you're putting yourself out there. So someone might argue with you and say, well, it didn't look like that, it looked like this. And then, so it's like, well, then you do it. And it's a fun thing, but anyway, that's all I've got to say.
Thank you very much, Charles. Okay, I think we've exhausted the time. Thank you very much, panelists, and thank you very much, audience. Yeah.